In Asia, it is said that ancient people had the power to communicate directly with the gods. Nature was a sanctuary in harmony with the perpetual cycle of life. A time of the sacred without architecture. Then 2,500 years ago, a man named Gautama became the Buddha, the Enlightened One. 300 years later, worship of his relics gave rise to one of the first sacred monuments in Asia, the Mahabodhi Temple in northern India. As the Buddha's teachings spread throughout the continent, it influenced a sacred architecture that places man at the center of the cosmos. From India to Japan, from Myanmar to Mongolia, each culture has integrated this concept into its own beliefs, giving rise to a multitude of temples and shrines as varied as the landscapes of this vast Asian continent. In India, birthplace of Hinduism, sacred architecture would take on its most flamboyant form, as complex as the infinite incarnations of its gods. These Asian temples share principles that combine circles and squares, symbolizing the sky and the earth, or the human body within the cosmos.
So the temple becomes a place for us to actually experience the cosmos in a structure.
Keys to help man decipher the workings of the universe. At the heart of the Hindu Meenakshi Temple in Madurai, in the region of Tamil Nadu, gods of stone have always been a part of people's daily lives. Each day, over 15,000 believers come here to visit and worship them. Everyone maintains a close personal relationship with the god of their choice. With almost a billion followers, Hinduism is the third largest religion in the world.
The temple is home for us Brahmins, but also for everybody. Even if everyone has their own home, the temple is everyone's home.
Until India's independence in 1947 and the end of the caste system, temples were reserved for Brahmins and kings. Built in the 10th century, Meenakshi was among the first temples to open its doors to all worshippers. It has become one of the most popular.
The temple ought to be a place where a man can face himself. Once a man discovers the true state of his soul, he can only want to improve himself.
A mirror of mankind, the gods reflect every human emotion. They fill each recess of the temple with their infinite transformations. They have 1,000 names and 1,000 faces. As they enter the temple, worshippers pour ash, symbolizing the cycle of death and rebirth, onto Ganesha, the elephant-headed god with a child's body. Ganesha is the god of benevolence, the link between the human and the divine. He brings people wealth and happiness. He is the most popular god in India. Outside, the pantheon of Hindu gods is displayed in a joyous Baroque disorder. It is said there are 33,000 divinities in Meenakshi Temple, representing the 33,000 manifestations of the three major Hindu deities. Brahma, the creator, Vishnu, the preserver, and Shiva, the destroyer, who renews life. Each god has taken on a human form. Perched on the stucco walls, they participate in the great cycle of life. Every 15 years, they get a fresh coat of paint because in India, color is a symbol of vitality. Color is the light emanating from the deities' bodies to illuminate the world of man. In ancient times, long before Hinduism, long before temples even existed, in the age of Vedism, one of the oldest religions in the world, the gods had only one dwelling place, the mythical Mount Meru, also known as Mount Kailash. It was considered the natural and spiritual center of the universe. Dr. Vedashalam, former director of historical monuments, has studied the origins of this temple.
During the Vedic age in India, there weren't any temples. People merely recited mantras and prayers. All living beings were considered temples, since each living being has a soul, and each soul is a representation of God. And then temples came about. The very first temples were inspired by the form of Buddhist temples. Each temple was based on the human body, because the human body was considered to be a holy temple.
The temple is not merely the dwelling place of gods, but the symbolic representation of a sacred body in human form. The temple is a living being, and the labyrinth of its courtyards, pillared halls, and corridors are its entrails. From the granite-pillared ceilings to the floors of sculpted stone, all its surfaces are holy.
The entire temple, from its foundations to its very top, is comprised of six parts, symbolically representing each of the six parts of the human body.
The foundations represent the feet, the walls, the body. The circular tambour represents the neck and head. And the gold spires, the top of the skull. Visible from far off on the horizon, the huge Gopuram Gateway Towers mark the borders of the Meenakshi compound. The temple sprawls over a surface of 6 hectares in the heart of Madurai, the city built around it. Like a beacon in the midst of the city, it watches over its prosperity, constantly reminding people of the permanent presence of the sacred.
The temple has a total of 12 gopurams, or gateway towers. Of the 12 towers, 8 of them were built when the temple was first constructed. Subsequent kings always wanted to make something bigger. And the last ones built the 4 great towers we see today.
Positioned at the 4 cardinal points, the gopurams surround the shrine at the center of the temple. Beneath its golden roof lies the most sacred spot, the realm of Shiva. From the start, the builders of Meenakshi adopted and adapted the principles of Buddhist architecture. The shrine where Shiva resides is built within concentric walls that represent the cosmos. The degree of holiness decreases as one moves away from the center. But a few centuries later, this perfect order was thrown off by the construction of a second shrine devoted to Shiva's wife. Ever since, the holy complex has developed around 2 centers rather than just 1. An architectural exception, unique in India, engendered from the unlikely love of the god Shiva for a woman turned goddess. A woman who gave her name to the temple, Meenakshi. The temple owes its huge popularity to the legend that joins a woman to a god. Every evening, their wedding night is reenacted. Concealed inside a palanquin borne by Brahmins, the only ones allowed to enter the sacred shrine, Shiva passes through the long hallways of the maze-like temple to join Meenakshi, who awaits him in her own shrine.
Meenakshi and Shiva have the power to bestow blessings and spread well-being upon life on this earth. They alone can grant nirvana, the final liberation from the cycle of life.
Each night, the god, exalted by human emotions, stops at the same spots in the temple so the Brahmins can fan and feed him.
We are like bees. They seek nectar to bring back to the hive to make honey. Like them, we bring all our power and wisdom to the center of the shrine.
Historian Jita Pai, professor at the University of Wisconsin, has studied Meenakshi's unique feminine figure.
She's popular in Madurai because people here in Madurai think of her not only as their goddess, but also as the daughter or the queen, the Pandyan queen, which is a dynasty that had its origins and its center here in Madurai.
According to legend, the king and queen of Madurai were unable to produce a son and heir, so the gods gave them a little girl as a gift. She was born with 3 breasts. They named her Meenakshi and raised her like a boy. She became an invincible warrior with perfect mastery of weapons. One day, she headed into battle on Mount Kailash, the home of Shiva.
And when she gets there and faces Shiva, her 3rd breast falls. And she realizes at that moment that he is to be her husband. So they were married with great celebration and festivities among all the people in Madurai, because they were so excited that their queen was getting married and their queen had become a goddess.
Meenakshi, now an accomplished goddess of love, femininity, and fertility, watches over her fellow women.
So we don't know in these temple legends whether everything in it is historical, that it actually happened. And that's not the issue here, because what's important is this is what people believe happened. And this is how they explain the temple, their goddess, and the god. People will refer to gods in the present. There's a belief or this feeling that gods are not only part of their daily lives, but alive.
In Madurai, the gods live like people, and people can become gods.
The sacred space is not circumscribed. It's very porous. It's very permeable. It's very flexible as well. The sacred is not just in the temple. It extends and becomes part of one's daily life.
Meenakshi is a very example of the living temple that never stops evolving and changing over time. But 200 kilometers north of Madurai, the temples of Tanjavur have kept their original perfection. Over 1,000 years old, Brihadisvara Temple is one of the most beautiful architectural gems of South India. The purity of its style, harmony of its proportions, and profusion of its granite sculptures make it an incomparable monument. It's devoted to Shiva, the most popular deity in the Tamil Nadu region. But what makes it particularly interesting is that the building principles inherited from Buddhism have remained visible and intact. Historian Pradeep Chakravarti has written several books on its architecture.
Ayatanavan bhavati yuagner ayatanam veda ayatanavan bhavati apovai agner ayatanam ayatanavan bhavati Yevam Veda, Yopa Mayatanam Veda, Ayatanavan Bhavati. So, and it goes on for a longer time. But it's curious that this hymn, which is considered to be the flower of all the Vedic hymns, does not talk about the gods that we really look at today, the Shiva and the Vishnu and so on and so forth. The gods that it actually mentions is water, fire, the moon, the stars, the seasons, and the rains. And when we commune with nature, there is a greater chance that we recognize God.
All Hindus share this respect for nature and believe in a higher consciousness called Brahman, considered to be the supreme God, creator of the universe.
So in the old days, in some of the Vedic hymns, for example, they conceptualized and gave this Brahman a form called the Vastupurusha, or the eternal human being, When we see that eternal human being in the earth and we build a structure around that human being, that becomes a temple. So the temple becomes not just a place for us to gather and worship, it becomes a place for us to actually experience the cosmos in a structure. Now, if you look at the Vastu Purusha inside, he's got his hands in prayer, and his knees would be on this side, and the feet come down over there.
Like Meenakshi, this temple represents the divine body in human form. It fits in the center of a square divided into multiples of nine, corresponding to the nine planets of Indian astrology. To keep the supreme deity from escaping, it's held down by secondary deities that live in the compartments around the central square.
And this point over here, the center point, will actually be the navel. And in fact, even in Sanskrit, this is called the Garbha Griha, which means literally the womb, and that's where the main deity is. So the focus of the attention is towards the center point.
Rising directly from the navel of God, the Vimana, a hollow pyramidal tower, houses the god Shiva. 70 meters tall and crowned with a huge 80-ton block of stone, the heavenly palace, the most sacred place in the temple, towers above the other buildings. A shrine that only Brahmins may enter to serve Shiva. The entire temple, made of granite, is covered with sculptures that are a treasure trove of 10th century Indian devotional art. The sculptures depict the god Shiva in his form as beautiful Lord in various sacred Indian dance poses. Like Meenakshi, the shrine is surrounded by double walls with a gopura marking the entrance. The temple's proportions are based on precise measurements that connect the different buildings. The square determines all the proportions of the design. The outer wall is composed of two squares, each with sides 140 meters long. The 70-meter tall Vimana corresponds to exactly half of one square. The layout of the buildings forms a combination of squares representing the earth and circles representing the sky nested into one another. A perfectly symmetrical design that is none other than the Buddhist representation of the cosmos found throughout Asia, the mandala. In Sanskrit, mandala means design, circle, or else center and periphery. It is the diagram that represents the order of the universe. It's all there, man and his body, the elements of nature, the sun and the planets. The Kalachakra mandala, called Wheel of Time, is the most complete portrayal of the cosmos. It comes from the Buddha's final teachings, laying out his path toward enlightenment. The Wheel of Time represents the great cycle of life, from macrocosm to microcosm, from the planetary cycle to the cycle of breath. Everything is under the influence of time. Robert Thurman, professor of Indo-Tibetan Buddhist studies at Columbia University in New York, was the first American to be ordained by His Holiness, the Dalai Lama.
Mandala is actually an alternative universe, really. But then the center of that universe is a kind of divine palace or a royal palace. And we are used to seeing mandalas in two dimensions, like a geometric diagram, usually a square and maybe circles in the square, or maybe sometimes several squares, one within another. But actually, that's the blueprint of a three-dimensional building, or sometimes several buildings, one inside another.
When meditating, one must visualize the mandala in its entirety, as well as in its tiniest details. Each cardinal direction corresponds to a color, a facet of the mind, and qualities of being. Through the power of concentration, one can conjure the ideal heavenly palace from the blueprint on the floor, where all the qualities of an enlightened Buddha are gathered. One can then move about freely inside and explore it mentally.
The technology of the mandala is creating a space where you feel totally exalted. You can allow your sensitivity to sort of blossom without fear of being hurt or in any way oppressed. And the building should reflect that kind of a exalting space. So this is a very high science, actually, about the nervous system, the programming of the brain, sort of, I call it psychic neuroscience, meaning coming from within your mind and using focused imagination with very high concentration power to create effects in your subtle nervous system. And then the idea of the building and the architecture is completely connected to that. So it's like a core psychological, spiritual science that underlies either Hindu or Buddhist temple architecture.
Bodh Gaya in North India is the most important Buddhist pilgrimage site in the world. This is a place where 2,500 years ago, a man named Gautama, after a long spiritual apprenticeship, managed to reach enlightenment. Seated beneath a tree, he became Buddha, the Enlightened One. For the first time, an ordinary human had broken the cycle of death and rebirth and achieved the state of omniscience reserved for gods. It was a political and spiritual revolution in a caste-ruled India, for it implied that anyone could also become a Buddha. 300 years after the Buddha's death, one of the first stone Buddhist monuments was built around the holy tree. Mahabodhi Temple is a stupa, a mausoleum that houses the relics associated with the Buddha. Worshippers walk clockwise around the cone-shaped structure to honor the Buddha's memory. Sacred architecture in Asia developed with the emergence of the stupa, the emblematic monument of Buddhism and a sign of recognition for its worshippers. Over the centuries, its form would change in accordance with various countries, schools of thought, and cultures. Because Buddhism developed outside India where it was born and spread across the Asian continent in three directions. Circling around the Himalaya Mountains toward China and Korea, all the way to Japan, toward the Tibetan Plateau, all the way to Mongolia, toward Myanmar, the gateway to Southeast Asia. When Buddhist missionaries reached Myanmar, the former kingdom of Burma was renowned for its gold and precious gems. Burmese kings adopted the new religion with fervor. They adapted Buddhism to their own worship of gnats, local spirits of the dead. Given its function as a reliquary, the stupa flourished amazingly here. Yangon, today's capital of Myanmar, is home to a giant stupa, the world's largest, entirely covered in gold. The stupa is shaped like an upside-down bowl in memory of the wandering monks who introduced Buddhism to the kingdom. It sits amid a forest of 64 small pagodas that form a sacred enclosure. Dr. Charlotte Galloway of the National University of Australia specializes in Buddhist art.
One of the reasons the Shwe Dagon is the most important stupa in Myanmar and so important in the Buddhist world is tied up in its histories, which are both legendary and also have some foundation in more in historical fact. But the legend here is that the Shwe Dagon Pagoda houses hair relics of the Buddha.
According to legend, the Buddha himself gave two Burmese merchants traveling in India 8 strands of his own hair. The hair was carefully brought back to Rangoon by sea, then over land, where it was placed in a specially built stupa.
So, according to local legend, the stupa was actually built at the time of the Buddha, so well over 2,500 years ago. But of course, from a historical perspective, we actually have no real evidence of a pagoda being built here until around about the 13th, 14th century. That is when we actually have really strong historical evidence documented of the importance of the Shwe Dagon and its significance even then for the kings of Myanmar.
At the time, Burma's capital wasn't Rangoon, but Bagan in the north. In no time, the reputation of the stupa with its exceptional relics spread throughout the country. The kings of Bagan offered gifts of massive gold to fund the construction of the small pagodas around the Shwe Dagon.
Come back and look at the architecture itself and the form of this building. As it stands today, it's very much a representation of some of the core aspects of Buddhist cosmology. So we have a foundational base, the classic sort of 8-sided form, 4 main sides aligned with the cardinal directions. And as we move up the layers, we move also through a spiritual journey.
The different levels of the octagonal base represent the earthly kingdom. Above it, the heavenly kingdom with its different stages of wisdom, which leads to the second to top level that corresponds to the accomplishment of the Dharma.
And right up at the very top, as we reach the spire, to the final goal, which is represented here by all Buddhists, which is actually the void, a final attainment of enlightenment. As we reach that peak at the top of the building.
Everywhere you look, there is gold and precious glass. The fact that Buddhism advocates salvation through the renouncement of the material world makes such splendor even more surprising.
Almost all the glass mosaics here were made by my great-grandfather and my father. I entered the family trade in 1998.
The heir to a long line of craftsmen, So Win Nang has been restoring a small pagoda for several months with his team. It is a meticulous task that must be repeated every 25 years.
We Buddhists believe in nirvana. To achieve it, we practice giving in order to gain merit. We make sure that everything looks nice and shiny. The colors we choose for the work depend upon the giver's tastes. For instance, blue is a royal color, so we use it a lot. Green is also used a lot these days because it's the army's favorite color, so we see a lot of green now. Mirrors represent purity and reality, but glass is transparent and we can see through it. It's a comparison with nirvana, because it's said that in nirvana, everything is transparent.
In Theravada, this branch of Buddhism, prevalent in Southeast Asia, the notion of karma is essential. One accumulates merit through acts of giving, including the giving of one's time, and with this, the possibility for better karma in future reincarnations. Mr. Wu Ailuin, president of a volunteer association, has been coming to the Shwedagon since he was a boy.
The members of our association, and all the other ones, are volunteers who come to do good deeds in the pagoda, but in turns. Not all the members come at once. If all 4,000 members came, there'd be no more room around the pagoda. When death comes, we think of all the good deeds we carried out, and we see the merit we've earned. There's no need to write our deeds down in stone, they're in our hearts.
Burmese kings also earned merit by surpassing each other in sumptuous gifts. Like this 15th century queen, who donated her weight in gold to cover the Shwedagon.
As we get right to the top, you can see this other decorative element, which is actually called the tea, which is an umbrella. And the umbrella is a symbol also associated with the Buddha, one that is well recognized throughout Asia as a symbol of royalty. And an umbrella is something that is always seen atop of a royal personage, or as in this case, a great spiritual leader.
For the tea's most recent renovation, the Burmese donated jewelry, silver, gold, and gemstones that were incorporated into the top of the umbrella, composed of 1,065 gold bells.
So everywhere we look here, we see everything here is a result of these acts of donation, the idea of earning merit by respecting the three jewels of Buddhism, which are the Buddha, the Dharma, which is the Buddha teachings, and the Sangha, the Buddhist monkhood. And all of that has come together in this living environment, which is continually changing as people are renewing, not just their own cycles of rebirth, but it's like a physical rebirth of this environment as well.
The donations that, in the Shwedagon, are concentrated in one single monument have taken on a completely different dimension in contact with forceful nature. North of Yangon, Bagan, Burma's ancient royal capital, was a kingdom of Buddha. A fabulous and yet very real vision of the divine world. On this immense plain, inspired architects built over 3,000 sacred edifices, making it the most important site of Buddhist architecture in the world.
I was born in Bagan, and I'm very proud of it, because there really is no other place like it in the world. I've worked for the archaeology department for 23 years. My father was also an archaeologist and a writer. For us, the inhabitants of Bagan, we've always believed this site was protected by the stupas, which contain relics of the Buddha. They have kept us safe from any danger. According to research, at the time of Bagan, the population lived around these religious monuments. There were close to 200,000 inhabitants in the region of Bagan.
Like the kings, common people over the centuries built temples and stupas of all shapes and sizes until they filled the entire plain. The largest monument in Bagan is also one of the most amazing. The Damayazika Pagoda was built in the 12th century and is a unique blend of temple and stupa. Crowned with a Burmese tea and surrounded by five small temples which provide access, the structure is shaped like a star, a sacred pentagon in Buddhist cosmology.
On August 24th, 2016, there was an earthquake of magnitude 6.8 in Bagan. Around 389 religious edifices were damaged.
Earthquakes are a frequent occurrence on this 40 square kilometer plain. Ancient architects built their monuments with clay bricks. Structures that may look fragile, but have weathered the test of time. Only the delicately pointed roofs didn't survive the elements. Multiple earthquakes have damaged one of the site's most beautiful architectural gems, the Ananda Temple. But once again, people have restored the monument's original splendor. With its succession of sculpted ornaments depicting the mythical Burmese lion, guardian of the site, Ananda Temple is an architectural synthesis of several beliefs. It was inspired by an Indian temple with its chiseled doors shaped like lotus petals, a symbol of purity. Its six consecutive terraces that represent the mythical peaks of Mount Meru lead upward to the Shikara, the tower shrine rising at the top of the monument. From each of the four cardinal points, a hall leads to the center, the holiest spot of the temple. Its design is perfectly symmetrical, a cross in the center of a square, like a mandala. Though today Bagan is a fragile and priceless archaeological site, it has continued to remain a place of worship that bears witness to the omnipresence of Buddhism in the daily lives of the Burmese.
The people and kings of Bagan understood the essential element of Buddhism. They knew everything was ephemeral and that we must grow old and finally die. A great deal of effort went into building these monuments, but they knew, with all the earthquakes here, that everything would be destroyed sooner or later.
Man grappling with unpredictable and destructive nature is also part of the eternal cycle of rebirth. And this seismic plain has become sacred over time. But what happens when Buddhism reaches a land without architecture? North of China in Central Asia lies the huge expanse of Mongolia with its untouched nature. This is the land of nomads and shamans. The land where men worship the gods of the sun and the moon, the earth and the sky. In the 16th century, Buddhism finally took root in Mongolia. In the face of such powerful landscape, temples would blend into nature. Tovkhon Monastery was built around a cave, a natural sanctuary hidden in the rock, made sacred by the presence of lamas who have come here to pray for centuries.
We meditate to discover ourselves. It's important to know oneself, to know one's mind. We ask ourselves, who am I? That's the goal of meditation. He who knows himself through meditation is able to master himself and find his path. This is how we can exist without suffering and live in peace. I am a master teacher here at the Tovkhon Monastery. I've been here since 1993.
Perched atop a rocky peak, the monastery's first wooden building was erected in the 17th century. It overlooks the Orkhon Valley, birthplace of the nomadic culture of the steppes. The unique site, known as Happy Secluded Place, is a renowned retreat for Tibetan Buddhist monks.
The natural environment of the Tovkhon Monastery means one does not come here by chance. One is driven to come here out of sincere desire and motivation. There is nothing but woods around. The place is solely designed for those who practice meditation. They can do so in utter tranquility. It's a separate world.
Monks The remote location of Tovkhon preserved it from the throes of history. But other temples in Mongolia suffered a tragic fate. Over the centuries, Buddhism gradually spread across vast Central Asian steppes in the wake of merchant caravans carrying silk and spice to the kingdom of the legendary emperor and conqueror, Genghis Khan. This is where he chose to set up his base camp and build the first capital of the Mongol Empire, Karakoram. Immaculate stupas, silent witnesses of a tormented history, trace a square in the middle of the steppe. They encircle the Erdene Zu Monastery, the first Buddhist center in Mongolia. Uranchimeg Tsultam, professor of Buddhist art at the University of California, often returns to her native land to study the origins of the monastery.
The site where Erdenzu is, even before other temples were built, big, huge gear was built for the founder, Abatai Khan, who is the descendant of Genghis Khan. And when he met with Dalai Lama in 1586, he was already stationed in that big gear. And it was so huge that a regular gear of nomadic people looked like a toy next to it.
Around his gear, Abatai Khan built the Erdene Zu Monastery, marking the establishment of Buddhism in Mongolia. His huge tent of canvas and wood became a portable monastery that moved across the steppe to spread the word of Buddha. All that's left of Abatai Khan's gear are the marks from its foundations. A huge stone circle inside the square enclosure walls, like a mandala.
Erdenzu was a very living organism. It really never stopped building. It began with its foundational gear, followed by building temples. And because it was never really stopped building, it built throughout 16th century, 17th century, 18th century, 19th century, and so on. It has a very variety of interesting architecture, all blended within the compound, enclosed by 108 stupas.
Erdene Zu owes its name to three jewels, the three Zu offered by the Tibetan spiritual leader at the time. Three sacred images depicting the Buddha, for which it was customary to build a temple. In a land with no architectural tradition, Abatai Khan had to call upon the expertise of renowned artisans from China to provide a home for the priceless treasure. An odd vision in the midst of the steppe, these three temples fashioned upon the model of Chinese palaces line up in perfect symmetry. They proclaim the omnipotence of Khan. In the 18th century, the Khan, now both spiritual and political leader, built the Lavran Temple in homage to his Tibetan counterpart. The temple evokes a spiritual and political influence of Tibet through its architecture, derived from the mountain temples of the Himalayan foothills. Unlike the stone temples of Tibet, Lavran Temple is built of fired brick and wood. A stupa rises in the center of the monastery. In these northern lands, the stupa is now called a chortan. Though its form evolved considerably during the long journey from India to Mongolia, the chortan has retained all the features of Buddhist cosmology. It represents both a human body and elements of the natural world. The foundation corresponds to the lower members linked to the earth. The dome at the level of the stomach symbolizes water. The 13 rings from the heart to the neck symbolize fire. The crescent that makes a head symbolizes air. At the top, the seed of supreme awakening is a gateway to the ether, infinite celestial space.
The stupa is usually for lamas, teachers, saints, and for Buddha relics. Here in Mongolia, they also worship the patrons of Buddhism and the Khans, who were very important to bring Buddhism to Mongolia. So Abata Khan, his grandson, and their queen, they were all enshrined in stupa in this compound.
The chortan became both a political and religious symbol, thereby abolishing the border between the sacred and the profane. The monastery transformed into an academy where generations of young nomads from the steppes learned to read and write and converted to Buddhism, abandoning their ancestral beliefs. At the start of the 20th century, nearly 1,500 monks prayed in the 65 temples within the walls of Erdene Zoo. More than half of the Mongolian population belonged to the clergy. Mongolia had become a theocracy modeled on Tibet. But in 1939, the Russian invasion of Mongolia sounded the death knell for the monastery. Erdene Zoo was the first victim of the unprecedented purge led by communists to eradicate Buddhism. The majority of the monastery's temples were destroyed and the monks executed. In the end, throughout Mongolia, the Soviets would execute 17,000 monks and lamas and would destroy almost every single one of the country's 2,000 temples. Seventy years later, the monastery reopened its doors. The monks and people had found their religion again. The ritual of circumambulation takes place around the 108 stupas enclosing the sacred fortress of Erdene Zoo. It is led by Orshik Erdene Shulun, Grand Lama of Lavran Temple, to commemorate the anniversary of the Buddha's enlightenment.
We're the younger generation, and we've taken over the pursuit of religious activities. Every day for 70 years, the old monks officiated, read sacred texts, prayed, and carried out their rituals in secret. Now, we no longer need to hide, and we pray openly every day, especially on holy days.
Like every year, the villagers come carrying a priceless bundle. The sacred texts each family hid in their gear during the communist purge to save them from destruction.
It was my own decision to become a monk. It wasn't my family who decided. No one pushed me to do it. And I chose to go all the way through with it. My name is Sanjidijit. I began my studies here, in the Erdene Zoo Monastery.
Oh,
I've lived at the monastery for 4 years. This year, I'm going to study at the Institute of Buddhist Religion in Ulaanbaatar. I'll be leaving soon. I like Erdenizu Monastery to remain the most important religious sanctuary. Once I've finished university in Ulaanbaatar, I'll come back to Erdenizu to work as a monk. My two teachers have a lot of confidence in me. I don't want to let them down. That's why I'd like to come back to Erdenizu and become a Grand Lama astronomer.
Like generations of young Mongolian nomads before him, Sanjaydijid represents the monastery's present and future. Rooted for centuries in the Mongolian land, Erdenizu managed to survive the brutalities of history and the attempt to wipe out the sacred. When Buddhism reached the Far East, its architecture attained a degree of perfection in harmony with the elements. In Japan, people have always communicated with the kami, powerful nature spirits. The encounter between the world of kami and Buddhism gave rise to an unprecedented syncretic architecture. In Sakurai, a Shinto shrine and a Buddhist monastery demonstrate this cohabitation of the sacred. Mount Miwa has always been venerated as the dwelling place of the divinity Okuninushi, the great landmaster. At the foot of the mountain, the presence of kami is marked by a torii, a symbolic gateway that separates the physical world from the spirit world. Here, in Omiwa Shrine, kami are omnipresent. There are millions of them throughout the archipelago, and they've always been part of the Japanese people's lives. Shinto, or the Way of the Gods, represents the ensemble of these beliefs and animistic cults. Mr. Hiraoka Masahiko is the Shinto priest of Omiwa Shrine.
In Japanese beliefs, the mountains, rivers, and sea are all hallowed. We believe the mountains, grass, and trees are filled with life. When we look at the legends, human beings, like nature, are born divinities. And that is why nature and human beings are considered brothers and sisters.
In the early days of Shinto beliefs, architecture was limited to small temporary shrines scattered on the mountain. They housed nature spirits that people could visit to worship. When Buddhism reached Japan, the spirit cult transformed into a formal religion, Shintoism. With the discovery of the concept of sacred architecture, the Japanese created sophisticated constructions.
Because it's located on one of the great mountains where kami dwell, Omiwa Shrine has the architectural feature unlike other shrines, of not having a main building as its central focus. The compound here just has smaller buildings for those who come to pray to the mountain.
There is no center building in Omiwa. The mountain itself serves as a sacred shrine. Shintoism has borrowed Buddhist architecture's structures, massive forms, and interconnected volumes. But it invented a new aesthetic style. The buildings are made entirely of natural wood and require constant upkeep and restoration. As in India, the Japanese deities don't like things to look run down. Buddhism did not replace animist beliefs in Japan. Even today, most wedding ceremonies are performed in Shinto shrines, in homage to the union of Izanagi and Izanami, the deities who created Japan by piercing the waters with their heavenly spear.
When Japanese people are face to face with nature, they feel everything is alive. They have a keen sense of the cycle of life, being born, growing old, and dying.
While Shinto is the pantheistic world of nature spirits, Buddhism places man within the cycle of time. Nearby, on the sacred mountain, is one of the oldest Buddhist structures in Japan. Tenzan's buildings were constructed shortly after the first Buddhist missionaries came to Sakurai from Korea in the 6th century. Captivated by the new religion, the emperor ordered the construction of this temple, thus introducing continental architecture to the archipelago. Kensuke Hanafusa is a resident priest at the Tenzan Shrine.
At the time, Japan was still a young country, and various schools of thought had been imported from the continent. It's rare for Japanese culture to keep something it adopts as it is. It likes to change and adapt things to make them its own.
The history of Tenzan is a perfect example of this. Originally a Buddhist temple, it became a Shinto sanctuary. Indeed, Shintoism and Buddhism, Japan's two official religions, have lived together for centuries.
It turned out to be easy to combine Shintoism and Buddhism, because even though each religion has its own way of looking at things, they do have a lot of things in common.
When Buddhist architecture reached these lands, it quite naturally adapted to the hilly topography. Dominique Buisson, art professor, photographer, and author of works on Japanese architecture, has studied this emblematic monument of Japanese syncretism.
In the Buddhist relationship with Shintoist nature, the name of the game is basically making architecture disappear and blend into the geography and the topography of the place. The buildings became smaller and different levels in space were explored. Gradually, the architecture, while remaining very Buddhist, took on a Shinto spirit.
Buddhist architecture from the early days retained building principles from China and Korea.
The only difference with the continent is that here, there was no stone, no bricks, only wood. So they built with wood, and trees set the scale. The thousands of pieces of wood were all obviously assembled without nails. They used only dowels and joinery.
The art of carpentry, an age-old skill the Japanese have become masters of. They developed systems of elaborate wooden joints and made spectacular adjustments in order to build ever bigger and taller structures. The Tenzan Shrine boasts a remarkable tower, the only 13-story pagoda in Japan. The quadrangular wooden edifice is a culmination of how the shape of the Indian reliquary evolved as it moved across Asia. First, the stupa in Myanmar, then the Chorten in Mongolia, and finally the pagoda in China and Japan.
When Buddhism came to Japan, it was still reliquary. But before long, it would become a mere constituent of Buddhism's iconic buildings. After that, it became practically an aesthetic element. The pagoda is actually an extremely sophisticated assembly of wood, consoles, and internal structural elements with a central pillar that can shift and adjust when the ground moves during earthquakes. This creates that famous snake dance, the undulating movement that allows the buildings to resist.
In Buddhism, as in Shintoism, sacred architecture expresses, above all, the power and intense beauty of nature. Further north, in Kyoto, former imperial capital of Japan, the thousands of temples built over the centuries have been incorporated into the urban landscape. Today, the city is a bustling metropolis where people live history in the present. On the hills north of the city, Daitokuji is the most secretive temple in Japan. Its name means Dragon Treasure Mountain. It's a timeless monastic complex built around three large buildings, the only ones open to the public. Around these, 22 private temples form a sort of Buddhist village that sprawls over 23 hectares. Each of these temples has its own garden, forming its own little world.
This is a monastery. The idea here is to go back to the basics of Buddhism, back to the direct teachings, the monastic community. which means we don't need images, don't need sacred texts or any complicated esotericism. What matters here is transmission from one person to another, from master to disciple.
Daikotuji is a Zen monastery. Zen is the most radical branch of Buddhism. It's a return to basics, getting back to the teachings of Buddha. Here, practice is what matters and what leads to self-discovery in complete harmony with nature and the divine. Each daily action becomes an act of meditation that focuses on the present moment. Zen practices consist of directly attaining the final stage of enlightenment, the gateway to the Absolute. In this quest, sound is a primordial tool. At the heart of the practice, it appears in the form of prayers and mantras, the sacred formulas intended to help reach the Buddhic state. Stomu Yomashita grew up near Daitokuji. A talented percussionist, he gave up an illustrious international career, notably with Mick Jagger, to devote himself to sacred music. In his quest for the absolute sound, he has mastered the art of playing the Sanukite stone, a 13-million-year-old volcanic rock.
What I'm actually looking for through music is sacred sound. I would like to hear it through Sanukite. And what does one need to create sacred sound? A sacred place. And the Hato in Daitokuji is a place that was specifically designed and specifically built in order to find the sacred sound.
The Hato is a lecture hall renowned for its exceptional acoustics. A perfect square, custom built to highlight the deep tones of mantras. This is where the rare sacred ceremonies open to the public are held. Stomu Yomashita introduced this one, which blends the sound of Sanukite with the sacred chants of Shinto and Zen.
It is sound from the invisible world that enters the visible world. And when the two are united, we find the sacred sound that I'm looking for. And I think that this is what prayer consists of.
The white sand represents the flow of water. And when we reach the ocean, the white sand with an undulating pattern represents waves. Everyone who sees the garden feels something different. But the most important thing is to truly feel it, because in reality, since it's a dry garden with no flowing water or waterfalls, one must nevertheless be able to hear the sound of water. To do so, one must quiet the heart. Only then can one hear the sound. I've often been told, hear with your eyes and see with your ears.
Nature and its observation lie at the heart of Zen practice. The garden is a primordial element in temple design. It's an integral part of the architecture, a meditation aid that must constantly be visible. Nature is reconstructed and enhanced. For Zen monks, the garden is a microcosm. While gravel represents a sea, rocks represent mountains.
The idea of nature in Zen is like these gardens. A whole is recreated. It's a sophistication of nature. And the goal is to find nature, but the nature of man.
In the most secluded recesses of Daitokuji lies Shinjuan Temple. This late 15th century hermitage was home to great Zen masters who developed the art of tea.
We're talking about the void, not something that contains nothing, but a state filled with an energy that opens every possibility. When we say Zen, there is definitely something, but if we expect something specific, then there is nothing.
Heir to this tradition, Master Yamada Sosho, senior monk of Shinjuan, receives Yoshiaki Nakamura, an architect specialized in tea houses.
In Zen, the religious background is purity. That's why we use white wood for the lattices and entirely molded posts.
Through an interplay of several modular openings, the temple creates a series of passages between the inside and outside, as if symbolizing the passage between life and death.
The architecture is truly splendid. But the question is, what purpose does it serve? It is there to teach future generations. First, so that masters can teach their disciples in young bonzes. For that, we need the best environment.
The tea house is the quintessence of Zen-inspired architecture. It must display humility. Ideally, the edifice ought to evoke a simple fisherman's hut. The Shinjuan Tea House is an exceptional place which has welcomed countless famous tea masters.
As the path of Zen evolved, the room became more cramped. As we venture deeper inside, we reach a space no bigger than just one or two tatamis in terms of a surface area. This explains why these places put us in an emotional state suitable for Zazen meditation. We are what is most sacred. If we manage to detach ourselves, we attain the sacred. If we cannot detach ourselves, we live in doubt. And that is why we say that the sacred is not something outside, but that we must all become aware of what is sacred within us. We are the sanctuary. I don't know where exactly. Maybe it's the heart, or here, or here. I don't know, but in myself and in you, Mr. Nakamura, there is a sanctuary.
Throughout its long journey across Asia, sacred architecture continued to change as it encountered other beliefs. Becoming the incarnation of man himself, of nature, and gods. Just like the concept of the endless cycle of life and eternal rebirth.